From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Election 2002, it was hailed as a sweeping victory for the GOP. But look closer at the numbers, and the real winners were incumbents. 98% of House incumbents went straight back to the House. 78 House candidates ran without major party opposition. In 360 races, the winner coasted to victory with a huge 20-point margin or more. In short, when the 108th Congress convenes in January, the deepest imprint will be that of the ditto, the triumph of incumbency. How did incumbents pull it off? Redistricting, extreme gerrymandering. After the 2000 census, states broke up their electoral districts and welded them back together in shapes that all but guaranteed incumbent re-election. There is one bright exception to the gerrymandering juggernaut, Iowa. The Hawkeye State had more competitive races than California, Illinois, and Texas combined. It's one of the few places in the country where candidates actually earn their seats in rough-and-tumble congressional races. Listeners, when 98% of incumbents win, is this election or coronation? Is democracy damaged by the incumbency juggernaut? And what does Iowa teach us about drawing districts designed for real democracy, not for lifetime employment? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining us tonight is David Garrow, professor of law at Emory University, who's looked at closely at American voting patterns. He had an op-ed piece in the New York Times yesterday entitled Ruining the House. Good evening and welcome, David Garrow.
Hi, Tom. It's good to be with you.
Good to have you. Also with us tonight from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, and hello, Mr. Garrow.
David Garrow, paint the picture for us. We have an awful lot of incumbents coming back, in particular to the House of Representatives, an astonishing number. What's going on? Why is this happening?
What was most dramatic to me, Tom, last week was, as you mentioned in the opening, how many races for the House of Representatives were won by huge margins,
mm-hmm.
where the incumbent is winning upwards of 60% of the vote.
So even if they have an opponent, and many did not have a major party opponent, is it the districts that have been drawn so carefully that they know that they're going to have this overwhelming partisan advantage?
The pattern appears to be one of sort of mutual partisan agreement, and some states like California are particularly dramatic examples of this, where the only congressional seat out of 53 that was actually competitive was the one that Gary Condit, the congressman involved in some controversy, was giving up.
Most populous state in the union. All the House seats up for grabs, and only one, that of a disgraced, scandalized House member, a real contest.
And of the other 52 California seats, only three of them were closer than 60-40. I think one was 59, one was 58, one was 55.
Is this something new?
It's not new, but it is getting worse and worse.
Mm-hmm.
What made it most dramatic to my mind last week, that in state after state after state, we saw close gubernatorial races, close senatorial races,
mm-hmm.
but a complete absence of any close House races, leaving aside, as you noted, most interestingly, Iowa.
We saw that only four House incumbents lost to non-incumbent challengers. How much of this do you attribute to the wild gerrymandering that came out of the 2000 census?
The gerrymandering clearly has gotten worse, not just at this last time, but in the last 20 years. And interestingly enough, here in Georgia, where I live, the Democratic Party, which went out of its way to try to maximize partisan advantage,
mm-hmm.
ended up with some egg on its face because two of the districts that had been badly gerrymandered, intentionally gerrymandered, went Republican. But whether it's through mutual back-scratching or through really extreme one-party partisan behavior, both of those styles of behavior, to my mind, in tandem, point us towards a national need for departisanizing or nonpartisan control of redistricting as is illuminated by the case of Iowa.
And we're going to look at Iowa tonight and talk to people there who have been intimately involved in that. But David Garrell, what was the standard method for apportioning these voting districts, for drawing these lines? My understanding is that you've had as few as two, like one Republican and one Democrat, who essentially sit down with the numbers and draw the lines, however crooked and crazy and wild and stretching they might be, in such a way that it ensured what's been described as an incumbent protection policy. Is it that much a closed process?
In some states, it certainly is. I think what's most dramatic in this, Tom, and these are sort of two big questions which are hard to answer. Number one, if we look back almost 40 years now to the one-person, one-vote revolution, constitutional revolution in the 1960s, mm-hmm. where the Earl Warren Supreme Court, first in Baker v. Carr, then in an Alabama case called Reynolds v. Sims, mandated for the first time in American history that legislative districts have to be of equal population size. Mm. Prior to 1964, state after state after state had wildly unrepresentative, unequal districts. So the possible, and it's a reach, I want to acknowledge, you know, is there a constitutional argument, constitutional issue in having partisan, highly biased, partisan districting in the same way that there would be, and we've seen this too in the litigation, if districting were designed so as to disadvantage people of a particular race.
So you're saying we may have to ultimately see the courts come in to break up this kind of mutual back-scratching where all seats are sewn up?
I think that question has to be raised. The other aspect of this, which I touched on only passingly in my New York Times op-ed yesterday that you referred to, is we look at how much more intensely, hostily partisan the internal politics of the House of Representatives are.
And why is that?
My hypothesis, my contention would be that we get that because so many, you know, such a high, huge majority of members of the House of Representatives come from districts where they don't have to pay any attention whatsoever to citizens from the other party.
Which means they don't have to give a darn about what their fellow representatives of the opposite party have to say or think on the House floor either.
Yes, and we see in issue after issue after issue how much more extremely partisan the policy behavior of the House and of the House leadership is than of what we see in the Senate. I think if we had a majority of House races that were competitive, where incumbents really had to attempt to appeal to more of the people in their districts, I think we'd have a different and better and healthier internal tone in the House as well.
David Garrell, are American voters being played for kind of suckers here? We have Election Day, but if it's all sewn up by the drawing of the maps in the first place, the deliberate, again, this incumbent protection policy approach, is it making kind of a mockery of people trudging to the polls to look at maybe, in many cases, no real opposition, or even when there is opposition, no real chance of removing the incumbent?
I think the biggest effect, Tom, may well be in just discouraging people from wanting to turn out. Take a state like Massachusetts. Now, people may have turned out in Massachusetts because it had a very closely contested gubernatorial race, which was a toss-up, which in the end was won by the Republican. Mm-hmm. But of Massachusetts's congressional seats, I believe six of them were uncontested. And the other four of them, I believe the closest was 60-40.
I know I had no choice when I looked down at the House of Representatives. And whether you want the single candidate who's there or not, it doesn't feel good. It doesn't feel right.
Yes, exactly.
David Garrell, thanks for painting the big picture for us. It's been great having you on.
Thank you. It's good to be with you, Tom.
David Garrell is Presidential Distinguished Professor at Emory University. His op-ed piece, Ruining the House, was in yesterday's New York Times. Jack Beatty, take a bead on this. How would you describe the cost to democracy and to our national politics of this eternal incumbency?
Well, it's shocking when you just compare it to 1992, the comparable year following the 1990 census.
Uh-huh.
And when you compare it on two scores, that of women and minorities, after the 1992, 19 women entered the House. This year, zero new women entered. In 1992, 22 minorities entered. This year, three. It's the people at the margin who don't even have a chance to get into the system here.
Wait a minute, Jack. I want to be sure I understand what you're saying. You're saying it's not only an incumbent protection policy; it's protecting white males.
Well, I don't mean that. All I'm trying to say is that it's much more difficult for a challenger to get running room, and the most marginal challenger is usually the outsider. The woman, the minority. And this makes it even more difficult when you have, 99% of House incumbents running who weren't running against non-incumbent challengers won. 99%.
So
Saddam-like.
If you're a real outsider, that is a woman or a minority, forget about it. But the thing here is, in many of these races, you don't even have a serious debate between two white guys.
No. And to get some of them out of there, they won't even pass the Edwin Edwards test. Edwin Edwards, the flavorful governor of Louisiana, once said, the only way I'm going to get out of office is if they catch me in bed with a dead woman or a live boy. And I think it'll take something like that to dislodge some of these people.
That's a pretty tall order. Jack, stand by. I want to welcome into our conversation Ed Cook. He's joining us from Des Moines, Iowa. He's the senior legal counsel at the Iowa Legislative Service Bureau. Good evening and welcome, Edward Cook.
Hi.
Thanks for joining us, Mr. Cook. I wish you would be good enough to explain to us why Iowa has more competitive races than any other state in the union.
Sure. And a lot of it has to do, I think, with the way that redistricting is done in Iowa. It's a fairly unique process. And essentially, the agency I'm with, the Legislative Service Bureau, which is a nonpartisan entity that normally drafts all the bills and amendments for the legislature.
Okay.
Is given the task of basically developing a proposed congressional and legislative redistricting plan, which will then get presented to the legislature. And it's for them, it's an up or down vote. They either accept it or reject it. And if it's rejected, then we go through this three times, which at that point, then they can do what they want. But for the first two, they can't amend it.
So you're saying when the new census figures come in, they're not dragged off to a smoke-filled room where a few high-ranking politicos draw lines to protect their incumbents, but rather it goes to nonpartisan state officials. And what is the criteria used for reapportionment?
Right, and basically the statute establishes it, and it's almost as significant as what we don't take into account as what we do, but obviously population is the most important criteria.
Mm-hmm.
The second most important criteria is respect for political subdivisions. On the congressional level, we follow county lines, and so essentially each congressional district is made up of a whole county. On the legislative side, we try to keep cities together to the extent we can and counties and try not to split them. And then your basic notions of compactness. What do the districts look like?
So if we look at the electoral map of Iowa, do we see these kind of districts in the shapes of gargoyles and goat intestines?
We try to avoid that. And so it really doesn't look that way. And essentially on the congressional side, there are completely whole counties, which are essentially blocks. And so we combine those in a way. And I think what's significant is the things we don't take into account, because we don't take into account any election information, any party registration data, any information in regards to where incumbents live. Or we don't really take into account what the current district looks like, since it's basically based on the population of 10 years ago.
Right. So you don't use any of the clues that would let you make a tailor-made district for someone to go back to Congress?
No, we don't look at that at all. Now, obviously, when we propose a plan, the legislature and the governor can then take that into account and when they look at it. But the basic philosophy, which I explained to the legislature, is that it's essentially a blind process, with the idea being that with using a blind process from a partisan standpoint, it ends up with a fairly fair result.
Ed Cook, stand by. We're looking at Iowa, the beautiful exception tonight to national
gerrymandering, and we're looking at the juggernaut of incumbency. Do you feel the cold hand of gerrymandering, gerrymandered incumbency in your state, in your district? Join us, 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We are talking tonight about the juggernaut of incumbency demonstrated in last week's national elections, especially to the U.S. House of Representatives, the juggernaut of gerrymandering, and the one state that's contesting it, Iowa. You can join the conversation. Did you feel the cold hand of gerrymandered incumbency in your state, your district, on the ballot that you put in the box? When 98% of House incumbents win, is this election or coronation? And why have we allowed our politicians to gerrymander invulnerability? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Our guest tonight is Ed Cook, who's at the heart of Iowa's system, a system that doesn't allow the state to take into account the kind of numbers and voter registration and political affiliation that allows politicians over all the rest of the country to draw districts guaranteed practically to put incumbents right back into power. Ed Cook, how on earth did Iowa ever corral its politicians into this system? Iowa politicians probably like to be reelected just as well as anybody else.
That's correct, and basically it came about obviously in the 1960s with court cases, and one person, one vote became into being. And so in the 1970s round, the legislature did what most other states did. They tried to establish legislative districts on their own, and that was challenged in court, and the Iowa Supreme Court ended up establishing a legislative districts. Prior to the 1980 round, the legislature decided that they would establish a process to kind of get around some of the concerns that the Iowa Supreme Court had raised, to try to look at population and compactness and things like mm-hmm. that, and to then give the Legislative Service Bureau, which had been in existence for quite a while, the ability, the challenge and the task of creating proposed plans for them to consider. So hopefully to avoid a court challenge, which they have in the 1980, 90, and this current round of redistricting, there hasn't been a challenge to the adopted plan.
And is there not even in the back rooms of Iowa's political kingdom, or are there no termites eating at the wood here?
No. And I think that's one thing that's been helpful is that, you know, since they've gone through this a couple of times, I think both parties kind of have an understanding and they trust the process. And that they know that at the end, since the state's fairly even politically in regards to the registration, that they feel like they each have a shot at winning elections. Mm-hmm. And so they understand that we're not going to take that into account. They trust the fact that we're doing it in a nonpartisan way. And so then it kind of takes that out of the equation. They'll wait for the plans. They'll look at them. And if a particular plan they find is being objectionable, they have the ability to vote it down.
Jack Beatty, The Washington Post said after the election, the magnitude of incumbency's triumph in last week's elections for the House of Representatives was so dramatic that the term election, with its implications of voter choice and real competition, seems almost too generous to describe what happened on Tuesday. Here's Iowa standing in opposition to that.
Well, good for Iowa. And, you know, I think this is that there is out there, when people start to think about what they don't like about American politics, I think eventually they would come down to the fact that they don't have choice. For example, Republicans in the state of Massachusetts, there's just no way that a Republican can ever look forward to getting a member of Congress or to even having a competitive election. And yet, I know that state well. I could take a map and I could make out for you equal districts that would make the Republican Party instantly competitive. So they are disenfranchised. And I think those people and Democrats in Iowa and in Idaho and sort of the left out groups wherever need to sort of say to themselves, wait a minute, we can through referendum get this kind of reform in our state and really shake up the political establishment in a way that this phony nostrum of term limits did not at all.
And, of course, it didn't happen. Fred Barnes wrote in the Weekly Standard that he reminded us that competition is the lifeblood of good governance. And he said, let's look at what happens when you don't have it. Members have to keep in touch with their constituents. Without it, they don't. Competition produces new faces. No real opponents, no new faces. It hastens the flow of new ideas. Without it, where are they? It combats the tendency of incumbents to become representatives of Washington to their districts rather than the other way around. It makes it harder for lobbyists and special interests to develop lifelong relationships with members of Congress. In short, it makes Congress more representative. That sounds like something we'd like to have.
Ed Cook, Jack Beatty, stand by. I want to welcome into our conversation David Yepsen. He's joining us from Des Moines, Iowa. He's a political columnist, a Bigfoot there for the Des Moines Register. Good evening and welcome, David Yepsen.
Good to be with you, Tom.
Thanks for joining us, David. David Yepsen, is there something unique about Iowa? Can Iowa pull? I mean, we're wondering if the whole country can look here for an example. Or is there something about Iowa and Iowa's culture and farmers used to big square fields with nice straight rows of corn and beans that makes Iowa open to, willing, ready to accept this as opposed to the dragon-shaped districts we get in the rest of the country? Or is this a model that could be followed elsewhere?
Well, I do think the political culture of the upper Middle West is quite a bit different than sort of the machine politics that you'll get in the city of Boston or in urban areas of the country. I don't think there's much quarreling with that. And I do think that this type of system could be replicated elsewhere. It works here for Iowans. Politicians in this state find that, excuse me, mm-hmm. politicians in this state find that what is important to them in getting elected is to get their campaigns going early, that the most districts in the state could be won by either party, and that the most important thing for a political party to do is to recruit a good candidate. And so while it'd be nice, they might think in the back of their mind it would be nice to play with the crayons like they do in other states, mm-hmm. the political incentive here is let's get this thing over with. Let's get these district lines drawn so we can go out and start recruiting candidates. And so as a result, Iowa was one of the first states in the country to complete both its congressional and legislative redistricting plan.
Because they're not tinkering in the back room forever, but give us a sense. You know Iowa politics, and you know politics beyond Iowa. Give us a sense of the difference it makes in a campaign for the House of Representatives to have districts that are not fixed.
For one thing, Tom, I don't think you need term limits in a state like this because you have such a change. I mean, 40% of our legislature, maybe a little bit more than that, will be newcomers in January. Mm-hmm. It just by shuffling the district lines as you do, I think it takes care of that problem of the need for term limits. I do think that there is one downside for Iowa in this. Mm. Four of our five congressional districts were very competitive in this last election. Now, all four incumbents who were involved in that did win. Mm-hmm. But it seems rather short-sighted of Iowa to put our incumbents at risk in Congress when other states are not.
I mean, because you never get seniority, or you're less likely to get chairmanships and seniority that bring home the bacon.
Exactly. You know, and until Congress changes the seniority system or the rest of the country adopts an Iowa system, you know, I worry that someday we're going to be chumps out here throwing out incumbents who have seniority. I mean, Jim Leach, former chairman of the House Banking Committee, was a highly vulnerable incumbent this time.
Yes, he was. He made it back in, but he had to go out and really contest it.
That's right. But are we being foolish in Iowa if we start throwing out our people and other states don't? So far, that's not happened. What I do fear is that the day one party has both the governorship and the legislature, there will be a temptation to play with the crayons. But right now, in all those elections that Ed mentioned, in the redistricting year of 2001, 1991, mm-hmm. it's been split control. The governor will be from one party, the legislature will be from another party. And so they pretty quickly decide there's no partisan advantage to be gained here. There might be hell to pay if voters think we're violating a good government tradition. And so let's just go ahead and get this over with and get our candidates in place.
Ed Cook, also there in Des Moines, how about it? Do you have people coming to you after dark and saying, Ed, we're being played for chumps by the rest of the country trying to do things right here?
Well, I don't necessarily get that. In fact, it's kind of amazing that most legislators are pretty happy. I mean, obviously there's going to be some that are going to be disappointed because there's winners and losers whenever you do this kind of process. But they generally, when we're in the process of coming up with the lines, are really good. I mean, I see them in the hallway or whatever, and they're very good about not, you know, making any kind of, well, can you do this or can you do that? They're pretty much, they understand the process, and they let it work its course.
Boy, we're lifting a cup of that Iowa spirit here tonight. We have a lot of callers who want to join this conversation. Phoebe's on the line. Hi, Phoebe. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
My comment basically is that I'm from Iowa. I'm actually flying home tomorrow
okay.
for Thanksgiving.
Happy travels.
Break from school. Thank you. I guess basically my comment is that I think the political culture in Iowa is very distinct. You know, we have the caucuses, and also I've personally had the experience of voting for, you know, I'm a diehard Democrat, But I've had the experience of voting for Republicans because I felt that they were going to vote their conscience, and I trust them. And I think that in general, Iowans trust the process, and that's really as important to them as voting in a partisan way for one politician or another.
But Phoebe, if Iowa has a distinct political culture, are you telling the rest of the country, forget about it? You don't have a culture that can support real competitive races?
No, I don't think that that's the case at all. I think that in one sense, Iowa has this culture which spawns this maybe potentially more fair process. But at the same time, as the process goes on, that also changes the political culture. So I think if you establish a procedure, a process which is more fair, then the political culture of the other states will follow.
Mm-hmm. So maybe good breeds good there. Phoebe, thank you for calling. Have a good flight back to Iowa. David Yepsen, it comes back to this notion that somehow Iowans, by history, by temperament, are uniquely kind of prepared to accept a system that's not fixed in a back room. But do we have to believe that?
Well, I think there's a lot to be said about that. I mean, if you look at I think that's true all over the upper Middle West. Some of the nation's good government reforms come out of Wisconsin, mm-hmm. Minnesota, Iowa. And so I think that is part of our tradition and our culture here, that elections should be fair. We don't steal elections. It's not a matter of civic pride the way it is in Chicago or some other
civic
places.
Pride to steal it when you can.
Well, it just doesn't happen. Mm-hmm. Elections are honest. That's just expected around here. But I do think it would work in other states if you have initiative and referendum where you could get the Iowa Code up as a ballot initiative, mm-hmm. and voters could impose it on the politicians. I think once politicians understood it, I don't think they would be as fearful of it as maybe they would initially. I mean, after all incumbents congressmen did get reelected here. If 40% of our legislators are new, that means 60% are returnees. They are incumbents.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
They just have to campaign a little harder than perhaps they do in other places.
Well, I wonder, Jack Beatty, put your finger in the national wind here. Have we become a national political culture that simply won't accept the rough and tumble of highly contested democracy?
I hope not. I mean, I think we've become a national political culture that feels divorced from our politicians. I think that is the sort of existential experience of most Americans today. Who are these guys? Who do they represent? And when you see the things that they argue about and that they debate about, it isn't ordinary people. I mean, it just isn't. And why is that? Well, part of the reason is that they're a kind of oligarchy who have fastened themselves upon us through this backroom deals and through inter-party collusion in Illinois, in Texas, in California, mm-hmm. and in New York this year. Both parties got together and said, hey, I won't make trouble for you and you don't make trouble for me. We'll all sail through this. Thus, you look at the Illinois results here, 81%, 82, 80, 67, 65,
these
84.
Are, these are huge victories
these are winning,
for incumbents.
These are winning margins. Right next door in Iowa, it's 52, 47.
I mean, as you said earlier, Jack, margins that the man Saddam would almost understand. Rich is calling from Milwaukee. Hi, Rich. You're on the air.
Yes, thanks for taking my call.
Good to have you.
In Milwaukee here, there was a candidate that was running against Jerry Klitschko for a number of years, a few elections. And every time that he ran against him, he got soundly beat. And what happened is they drew the lines again, and he was running against, he pretty much got his own district, and he ran on pro-life and anti-gun control and was in a real conservative district, and he won hands down.
And that's all it took. Rich, how does that leave you feeling as an American citizen, American voter?
That's really bad, especially all they had to do was just adjust things, and he's in. And in my view, he doesn't represent the majority view at all. You know, that's not the majority view in this area. Although, after the last election, I'm kind of like in the suburbs of Milwaukee.
Right.
So, it's a little bit more conservative out here.
Well, it may be the majority view, and it may be not the majority view. But if it all gets decided, if it's reapportioned in such a way that you can win just on one or two hot button issues, then you know it's been crammed down into a narrow political groove. Rich, thanks for calling. I want to get another call here. Fayyad is calling from Natick. Hi, Fayyad. You're on the line.
Yeah. Hi. Thanks for calling my call.
Sure.
Taking my call, Tom. The point I wanted to make was I think there's an important piece of the incumbency discussion that's missing from this, which is gerrymandering certainly contributes to incumbents getting elected overwhelmingly. But the other important part of it is the campaign finance reform.
Yeah.
I think incumbents just have an incredible opportunity, both in terms of name recognition and money-raising ability, that it is very difficult for any viable candidates to emerge to challenge the benefits of incumbency, whether blatant gerrymandering is done or not.
Well, there it is, and they kind of go hand in hand. Fayyad, thank you for raising that. David Yepsen, what about that? When big money interests look at the Congress and they see people districted so that they're going to be there for life, those people are worth big investments. Has Iowa avoided that, or are you seeing your politicians pulling down the same big box that the rest of the country's politicians are when it comes to election time?
No, they're pulling down the same big bucks here that they are elsewhere. And I think Fayyad has a good point that just solving the problem of getting rid of gerrymandering is not going to solve the problem of big money in politics. I think those are two distinct problems. I think they have different cures. So we still have a horrendous problem in this state with money in politics, just like they do everywhere in America.
Well, we don't want to say that it's one over the other, but we're taking on one tonight. And I wonder, Jack Beatty, if as profound as they both are, if redistricting in some sense doesn't come even before the issue of big money buying influence, because even if you get rid of the big money influence, if it's gerrymandered completely, how does that opponent even get up in the blocks?
That's right. I mean, he doesn't even get the sort of threshold credibility because the politicians have chosen the voters. The voters didn't choose the politicians. I mean, it is public financing of elections coupled with some kind of fair, non-political redistricting could really be a kind of political revolution in this country and make it possible for non-millionaires and non-purchased people to run for office.
But it does make those incumbency-guaranteed politicians a real kind of attractive thoroughbred for big money because they're going to be there and be there and be there.
You keep watering them every year. You know, they're
yeah, you keep watering them, and you know what that leaves us with. Well, we are talking tonight about the juggernaut of incumbency, of gerrymandering, and the one state that has contested it. Ed Cook, I want to thank you for joining us tonight. It's been great having you on. Are you determined to keep it going out there, Ed?
Well, I haven't heard any talk of changing the process, so my guess is in 2010 we'll be going through this same process again.
Well, we look forward to hearing about it. Ed Cook is Senior Legal Counsel at the Iowa Legislative Service Bureau. Thank you for joining us, Edward Cook. Listeners, we're going to take a short break. We're going to come back. When 78 House members face no opponent of a major party, what's the message here? Do you, as a voter, feel disempowered? Is gerrymandered incumbency creating a permanent political class answerable to no one, or at least to no ordinary voter? And if protected incumbents are almost guaranteed re-election, do they listen to you? Do they need to? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the juggernaut of incumbency, of gerrymandering behind so many of the victories in the House of Representatives races, if you can call them races, last week. And we're talking about the one state that's contesting that trend, Iowa. What can we learn from the Iowa example? And are we turning over enough new soil to get a healthy crop in Washington? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Our guest is David Yepsen. He's political columnist for the Des Moines Register. You're welcome to join us as well. Stephen's calling. Welcome, Stephen. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I think that we ought to get rid of the entire concept of redistricting. And we'll avoid the gerrymandering, we'll avoid the lawsuits, we'll avoid the fighting.
How do we do it?
We should adopt a parliamentary-style election for House members in each state.
How does that save us from the crinkly lines of gerrymandered districts?
We don't use districts. Each party puts up a slate of candidates with enough people to fill all the House seats. The populace votes by party. You apportion the representatives to the parties based upon the proportion of votes they get, much like they do in parliamentary systems in Europe and elsewhere. And you have, instead of having 51% of the people represented by their congressmen, you have closer representation to the way the people are distributed.
Well, there's a thought, Jack Beatty. Are we going back to the future here in the footsteps of the mother country parliamentary system? It's hard to picture.
Proportional representation is sort of the ultimate goo-goo idea. I'm for it. I like it. It's revolutionary in the American system. But, you know, only two democracies, sir, as I understand, have the first-past-the-post-win system, which we do, ourselves and the British today. And you can't argue that it's serving us well when we had a political scientist on the program the other night who said the metaphor for the country is the frozen republic.
Mm-hmm.
How none of the impulses of change that go through our society and our business every day manifest themselves in our politics.
But Stephen, I want to put it back to you. If it was statewide elections for all these representatives, how do you get those representatives' noses down in the very local concerns of a particular geography?
I don't know. You know, I mean, certainly it changes the dynamic a lot. And you're not voting. People are no longer voting for the parties. They're voting. Sorry, no longer voting for individuals. They're voting for the parties and lists of people from each party. It really changes things tremendously.
Well, there's a suggestion. Let's just turn it upside down. Stephen, thank you for your call. Lisa's calling from Worcester, Massachusetts. Hi, Lisa. You're on the air.
Hi. My question concerns the Supreme Court. I know the Supreme Court has ruled several times on redistricting, and I'm wondering how that affects our conversation.
David Yepsen, have you followed the court on this from Iowa?
Some. What the courts are saying is that when politicians start drawing district lines, they have to keep the population variances within certain limits. In Iowa, the courts have said, if the legislature sees a redistricting plan and wants to go to a second plan, they may do that, but the population tolerances have to be even smaller. Mm-hmm. So it forces the drafters of redistricting plans to constantly beat their last plan in terms of the population difference between the largest district and the smallest. And so you wind up with legislative districts that vary by maybe a few dozen people. And that really the one man, one vote principle is sort of the guiding light that guides all redistricting in the country.
Hmm. Jack Beatty, David Garrow was suggesting at the top of the hour that this may ultimately have to be decided, though, in the court and maybe along one man, one vote lines.
Yeah, I went back this afternoon and took a look at some of the language in that Baker v. Carr decision, and what that 62 ruling stresses is political equality. And we've just seen, you know, in the Florida case, this court bent over backwards on arguments that, when some people would say, tipped over, to the argument that there was not equal protection of the laws because of different ways of treating ballots. I think Republicans in Massachusetts can really easily say they're not getting equal protection of the laws. And by the way, Massachusetts, Elbridge Gerry was the 1811 governor of Massachusetts who introduced this word. He tried to dish the Federalist out of office, and he drew these squiggles on the map. And Gilbert Stuart, the portraitist, saw this, and he put a tail on one of these districts. He said, "Look there, there's a salamander." And his friend said, "No, no, it's a gerrymander."
He should know. He painted George Washington. Lisa, do you have confidence that if this did go to the Supreme Court, that the court that we have now would come back and say, this is wrong?
I don't have any confidence in our Supreme Court. I think that it's been handpicked by people who have particular agendas in mind, and I think that's part of what I'm concerned about is that it has gone to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court hasn't seemed to have seen anything wrong with what's currently going on.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes, Lisa, thanks for your call. David Yepsen.
Tom, I think if good government types want to try to force change on this issue in their states, I think they've got to head to the courts, because while I'm as cynical as the next person about politicians in the courts, I do have a little more faith in court systems than I do in legislative bodies, because there is this real wealth of case law on what has to be done in reapportionment. So if in redistricting or reapportioning, Massachusetts Republicans feel they were cheated, I mean, I think that the courts are definitely a way to get some remedy here. Certainly it was what happened in our state 30 years ago. And then through the ballot initiative process to try to simply impose a new system on the politicians. I don't think you're going to ever see a system as dramatic as what Stephen was talking about earlier with going to a parliamentary type of system. I just think that's you're not going to get there. But I think if people are good government types who want to try to do something about this problem that we're talking about, I think you've got to head to the courts as a place to start forcing some change in these legislative bodies.
Well, and then maybe to a referendum. Have you seen referendums raised elsewhere outside Iowa, David Yepsen, where there's been a big enough popular movement to get a serious effort to rein this in?
No, I have not. And I think partly the reason for that is this only comes up once every 10 years. I think many activist organizations are into other things. This is certainly not as electrifying as some of the other issues that you can get in a ballot initiative, you know, abortion rights or gay rights or that kind of thing. And so I just think a lot of good government groups essentially overlook this question because it doesn't come up very often.
On the other hand, in the 90s, certainly the anti-incumbent drive was very large. There was legislation headed in that direction.
Yeah, that's right. They put their efforts into term limits as opposed to the systems used for drawing district lines. And as I said earlier, I think if they put some of the effort into changing the way district lines are drawn, you don't need to have term limits. The voters will just naturally turn over the electorate,
the
incumbent.
I wonder if it's just 2 degrees too complicated to make a good, snappy referendum initiative, term limits versus redistricting.
It may be.
David Yepsen, I know we have to let you go. Thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you for having me.
David Yepsen joined us from Des Moines, Iowa. He's a political columnist and Bigfoot reporter there with the Des Moines Register. Well, Jack, here we are. The census comes once every 10 years. The politicians get their mitts on those numbers and the meaning of those numbers before anybody else does. And in most states, you know, it pops out of the oven and there it is. I'm not even sure it gets second guessed by the public.
I don't think the public even notices it. I mean, you talk to people who are completely left out, but even indignation dies after a while just by the sheer momentum of habit. This is the way it is. We accept it. But, you know, as recently as just 10 years ago, it wasn't this way. It's partly the computer revolution that allows them now to go right down every block and say, well, we'll take the Republicans who play the tuba, but not those who play the piano. And they can do that on the computer. So, you know, they can put together these voter-proof, competition-proof districts.
Technology letting politicians fine-tune gerrymandering to a fine art.
Yes, indeed, and to our cost, I think.
Well, the issue is raised. It's out there. What are we going to do about it? Jack Beatty, thank you for joining us this hour.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation online. Go to onepointradio.org and click on Forums. In a moment, a survivor of Cambodia's killing fields speaks out through his art. This is On Point. Between 1975 and 1979, Pol Pot and the Khmer Rouge carried out a campaign of genocide that killed 1.7 million Cambodians. It may seem like ancient history to some here in the United States, but this brutal past still haunts Cambodia and its people. Independent radio producer Ken Schulman recently traveled to Providence College in Rhode Island to visit the Spirit of Cambodia, a 3-month-long cultural project. While there, he met Phan Nocht, a survivor of Cambodia's killing fields. In this radio diary, Schulman shares Phan Nocht's remarkable story.
In late December 1977, a man in a northwestern province of Cambodia was arrested for no apparent reason. The man was Phan Nocht, a 31-year-old sign painter. He wasn't rich, he wasn't an intellectual, he wasn't interested in politics or power. Nocht was taken to Tuol Sleng Prison in Phnom Penh, the Cambodian capital, where he was interrogated, tortured, and starved. Today, Phan Nocht's hair is completely white. His voice is muffled, faint, as if filtered through gauze. 15,000 Cambodians perished at Tuol Sleng. Phan Nocht is one of 7 who survived. After 1 month spent shackled in a communal cell, with Nat near death, the sign painter was summoned by the chief guard. Nat thought he was headed to his execution. Instead, he was taken to a workshop where he was ordered to paint a portrait of Pol Pot. He was promised that he would be well fed and that he would have all the necessary materials. He was also promised that he would be killed if the painting did not come out well. On January 7, 1979, exactly 1 year after Nat's arrival at Tuol Sleng, Vietnamese forces invaded Phnom Penh and deposed the Pol Pot government. Nat escaped and joined the new Cambodian army. 6 months later, on leave from the military, he returned home and discovered that much of his family, including his two small children, had died of starvation under the Khmer. Today, at 56, he lives in Phnom Penh, where he runs a restaurant. He and his wife, who survived Khmer rule in the countryside, have two new children. In 1993, Nat started to paint again. Some of his paintings are images from Tuol Sleng, but most are lively illustrations of rural Cambodian life. One painting on display at Providence College shows the festival of Ptumben, or Ancestors' Day. Ptumben is an ancient Buddhist holiday that falls during harvest time. In the painting, the population of a small town brings offerings of food and provisions to the monks at a local temple. The scene is a happy one. The colors are light and gay. These days, says Nat, Ptumben is more popular than ever, because there was no one in Cambodia who did not lose their mother or their father or their brother or their sister or their uncle during the Pol Pot regime. We all feel so bad. We feel so sorry that during that time we didn't have rice to provide those who were hungry. We didn't have medicine to provide those who were sick. By making these offerings, we know that we are liberating the souls of those who have passed away before us. It is one of the inherent ironies of genocide that by generating a surplus of victims, it also devalues their stories. At 25 years' distance, Van Nat's arrest and imprisonment are no longer news, replaced in the media and in our minds by more recent mass murders and genocides. Nat's paintings of prison seem like mute, iconic scenes of someone else's martyrdom. Nat still meets occasionally with researchers and journalists who want to know about the killing fields and about Tuol Sleng. Sometimes it's hard for him to recall the beatings and the electric shocks, the screams coming nightly from nearby cells. Sometimes, often, he has nightmares too awful to recount. The one thing he never asks himself is why. Why he was arrested. Why he survived. This, he says, is how his life turned out. This, however inexplicable or unexpected, is his destiny.
Ken Shulman is an independent radio producer. He lives in Cambridge, Massachusetts. The Spirit of Cambodia exhibit continues at Providence College through December. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Cassettes and CDs of On Point are available for $15. Go to onpointradio.org or call 1-800-909-9287.